The next matter on calendar is 59590, Logan versus State. Mr. Cornell, on behalf of the appellant, are you ready to proceed?
I am. If it pleases the court, I'm Richard Cornell, and I represent the appellant, Devon Logan. I saw the quizzical look on some of your faces. I figure if this is a case where I'm challenging a statute, I ought to bring along a copy of the statute so you can see where I'm going. Okay? Hence that. This, quite frankly, strikes me as a very disturbing case from the cold record. When I read this record, meaning the trial record and exhibits, I'm struck by two things. Number one, it strikes me as a civil case, really. And number two, from the perspective, at least on the cold record.
Mr. Cornell, I don't mean to interrupt you, but do you want a rebuttal time?
If I have any left, sure.
Okay,
thank you. From the perspective of Harold Walker and Bill Walker, it doesn't strike me as a particularly solid civil case. And I say that for these four reasons. Number one, the key moment in this case, factually, in my opinion, was not when Harold Walker signs the deed in the hospital. Because after all, it was the title company that prepared the deed, the title company that brought the deed to him, and the title company that notarized the deed.
Who asked the title company to prepare the deed?
Both of them, and that's the key moment in time. It's when they signed the escrow instructions. That happened 2 months or so before. And what was Harold's state of mind at that point, and what did Yvonne do to make Harold sign the escrow instructions? The record is disturbingly silent in that regard, other than what the defendant testifies to and what the loan arranger, Sean Bennett, testifies to. Essentially, what you have is a description of Harold as being a really pretty sharp guy and very decisive in what he decides to do. Secondly, the testimony of Yvonne and Sean Bennett is they signed these escrow instructions after they consulted with a CPA. Now, we don't know who that CPA is. We don't know what that CPA advised, but that's what they testified to. There's no evidence to the contrary. Thirdly, there's no evidence in this record of what Harold Walker's dispositional or testamentary intent was when he signed the escrow instructions. It'd be one thing if he had left a will, a vanilla will, if you will, leaving half to Yvonne and half to Bill. There's no evidence of that. We don't know what he would have done before signing the escrow instructions. And fourthly, Yvonne and Bill were technically not biological daughter and son, but stepdaughter and stepson, but the relation between Harold and Yvonne was like father and daughter. Yvonne was the daughter and the caretaker for Harold for 14 or 15 years before they signed the escrow instructions, which makes you think that indeed, on those facts, it may well have been Harold's intent all along to give away most of his estate during his life to Yvonne. How do we go then from an iffy case like this, an iffy civil case, to a proof beyond reasonable doubt criminal case that puts my client in prison as we speak? I think it comes from the statute itself and the way it was defined in the jury instructions, but our position is the statute is unconstitutionally vague. Here's why we say so. We start at the bottom of the statute. It says it's used in the subsection undue influence. Does not include the normal influence that one member of a family has over another. Submitted to your consideration, nobody in this room can define what the normal influence that one member of a family has over another means. Actually, I can't do it. My opponent has a trial. I use exactly Smith better to say not abnormal, which doesn't help. Nobody here can do it. It's vague as can be. Now, my opponent takes this position, assuming you're right, that this phrase is unconstitutional vague. What does that do? All that does is knock out undue influence where else it appears in the statute, which is right here. So all that does is knock out subsection A, and the state's position is well. Then if we have a case where the defendant is converted from an asset to property to the only person or vulnerable person, i.e. Harold Walker, with the intent of criminal depriving him of those things, then we have our case.
Why do I have a problem with that as a matter of statutory construction? First off, undue influence is modified in the statute with as used in this subsection. What subsection? Subsection 2, subsection A, which is it? If the legislature meant subsection 2, subsection A, why didn't it say that? And if the legislature meant that, why do they have this phrase indented at the bottom of the statute instead of in the bottom of subsection A? Here's my answer. If we go to subsection 2, what does it say? Exploitation is any act taken by a person who has the trust and confidence of another person. Now, what is trust and confidence? That's a phrase that's unique to undue influence law. And it begs the question, can family member, can one family member have a trust and confidence in another family member, in another person? This statute defines them. Not undue. Yes, except with a normal influence that one member has over another.
So actually, it excludes it, is what you're saying.
Yeah. So what? It would seem then, if it gets us back into this loop, the trust and confidence is ultimately the issue, which is undue influence, but undue influence is unconstitutionally defined. Now, rather than just say, well, that's a lot of sophistry, you're creating a straw man and knocking it down there, as I say, let's look at the statute. Let's look at the jury instruction
and see how the jury was instructed, see what the court came up with and how to define this
to the jury. Now, this comes from the closeness of the record, instruction 25. By the way, instruction 26 is 107, is a restatement of the statute that we did that of 205.9.2. The jury is told the elements of the charge against Yvonne Love are as follows. Harold Walker was, at the time of the offense, an older person or only one person. No question that he was. Yvonne Logan did obtain the trust and confidence of Harold Walker. Again, begging the question, can a family member do that? He said he can. Now, three, that's the kicker. Yvonne Logan did any act to obtain control through deception, intimidation, or undue influence, and or did any act to convert. And or, what does that mean? One or the other or both, take your pick. If you like Yvonne, you pick him. If you like Harold, you pick or. What is this word doing here? This word itself is ambiguous, which is a product of the ambiguous statute. The statute is vague. The jury instruction doesn't save the statute. It makes it worse. So I would submit to you that no jury could probably return a conviction in this case on that statute, and that's how this hippie civil case became a criminal undue influence case. If I have time, I'll reserve it.
Thank you. You have nearly 7 minutes.
Good afternoon, members of the court. I'm Terry McCarthy, Deputy DA from Washoe County, on behalf of the state. And I don't find this particularly disturbing, unlike Mr. Cornell. I think that what we have here is the legislature took something that occurs all too commonly in our probate courts and allow for a criminal sanction. Nothing more than that. The statute, well, let me first say this. Sometimes it takes this process of months of drafting and arguing and the court summary before it finally becomes clear what is at issue. We now have it. The appellant says it is undisputed that Mr. Walker was competent at certain stages. It is most definitely disputed. This court summary, I didn't mention that because I saw it this morning, said Mr. Walker didn't recall whether he had agreed to this transaction. That is not so. He testified many times. He said, this didn't happen. I never agreed to this. Competent or incompetent, it didn't. When he was asked, do you recall having this conversation? The answer, quite properly, was no. When he was asked, did it take place? The answer was no. So the assumption that we have all agreed that Mr. Walker was competent at various times in this, or that he even had that conversation in which he instructed someone to prepare a deed, that is most definitely disputed. There is more than ample evidence to show it never happened. Now, I also say we needn't really address the constitutionality of the statute. It's parts of it are very simple. A person having the trust and confidence of another of a vulnerable person who converts that person's property with the intent to permanently deprive the owner is guilty. That's not ambiguous. That's clear enough. The word conversion was a part of common law. It's a term well known to the common law. And when the legislature uses a term well known to the common law, they intend to adopt. It's the only issue to know if this is allowable. It's hard to figure out because you can stop with the word, with the part that says convert. Mr. Cornell would say, in analyzing the statute, start at the end, start at the bottom where it says normal family influence. I generally start at the top. I start at the beginning of a statute. And we read through it, and when you get to the point where it converts the property for their own use with the intent to permanently deprive, there's a period at the end of that. You can stop now. So there's no need to. However, if there was a need, I'd say undue influence has a meaning. It has a well-known meaning, again, and it's used in every state of this nation. And it's right, I can't describe it in less than 10 words. Nor can I describe the normal family influence in less than 10 words, and I wouldn't propose to. I'm not aware of the constitutional requirement that it be limited to 10 words. I would say my understanding of undue influence in the context of this type of thing that arises in the probate court means something other than salesmanship. That is, it's not persuading someone to do something, it is persuading them to do that which they don't want to do. So, but again, we don't have to reach that because evidence showed that Mr. Walker was incompetent at the time he signs the deed. Probably also, if there was a discussion about escrow instructions, probably also incompetent then. But certainly, at the moment he signs the deed, I suggest this is simple enough. If you have an incompetent person, any influence is undue influence. The contract itself is void. You know, if we go just a basic kind of thing, it's voidable. I went to law school before the eighth grade, but I really can't remember that part. But it is at a minimum voidable if you had contact with an incompetent person. I suggest to you that the legislature has taken that very common scenario of someone getting an incompetent person to sign a deed and said that all by itself is a crime.
Now let me ask you, are you claiming that he was incompetent because of the medication and the surgery that he got through and the trauma of that, or is there another basis for ongoing incompetence that goes back for a period of time?
My recollection of the evidence was that it was the cocktail of medications
right.
That created the incompetence.
Which brings back the issue I posed earlier with the deed. There was an agreement apparently long before this that a joint agreement to have the deed prepared by the title company.
Well, Ms. Walker denies that. His testimony denied that there was any such agreement. We asked at various times, he would say, I don't recall, that on page 254 of the appendix, did you meet with him at any time during that time frame before the surgery? The answer is no. Absolutely not. I did not. I did not have that.
And there was no other testimony to the contrary?
Yes, of course. The appellant testified that there was a meeting.
Other than the appellant, was there any other testimony that would support that?
I can't recall if the
title agent
or the loan broker person may have testified that way too. I really don't know. The question is there sufficient evidence? Right now, because we don't get to make these factual findings in the first instance. Much of the argument is based on the premise that the jury was required to believe that there was this voluntary agreement. Well, according to Mr. Walker, there was none. It never happened. He said, I never wanted this. I never instructed anybody to sell my property or give my property away.
Were there signed escrow instructions signed by Mr. Walker?
I don't know there is such some debate about whether he signed that. Yes. I can't recall. His testimony was that he never wished it. Not that he didn't recall wishing it, but that when he said this meeting never took place.
Mr. Cornell said the escrow was signed after consultation with the CPA?
There's no evidence of that. Mr. Walker denied having met with the CPA. There was other testimony from the appellant, for instance, that they were advised to consult with the CPA. But there was no CPA testified. Had there been, we're not done with this case. Of course, you may know that the other half of my job involves claims of ineffective assistance of counsel. And had there been testimony from a CPA that says, I met with him, and I'm the moment, this is what he wished to do, and there was further evidence that at the moment he signed that deed, he was confident at that moment, the outcome is different. My position is based on the undisputed allegation that, I didn't say undisputed, I'm sure it's disputed, on the allegation that Mr. Walker was incompetent at the moment of the transfer. He may also have been earlier, but escrow instructions don't transfer property. It's the deed that transfers the property. And that's the truth. What happened here is the appellant went to an incompetent stepfather, handed him a pen, handed him a deed, and he signed it. My construction of the statute is any influence is undue influence where the victim is incompetent, including handing a pen and saying, sign here. It would void the transfer in a civil court, and the legislature is allowed for criminal sanction just for that.
Mr. McCarthy, was there evidence that when Mr. Walker signed this deed that he produced identification for the notary public and also the notary could verify it was him and make the standard acknowledgments contained in the deeds?
I couldn't say. I don't recall that. There may have been that the loan officer or whoever appeared in the hospital said, this transfer took place in the hospital. The victim was in the hospital.
I just wonder, was there any evidence that the notary book was signed, by Mr. Walker? Again, the notaries were required to keep.
I couldn't say. I don't have an answer for that. I wouldn't be surprised if someone testified that was him, but the time would be.
I'm concerned if the book was signed, it sounds like a more regular transaction. If somebody just shoved a piece of paper in front of you and somebody slapped a notary stamp on it, then in my mind it becomes a little more suspect, So I don't know what was presented to the jury on
I don't know either. I think that having a notary verify the signature is not evidence that someone was competent. So I don't think that would change anything. And the claim that he was competent earlier, at the time of the escrow instructions, when he said prepare the escrow instructions, if he had that conversation at all, I don't think it matters too much because that's not the crime. The crime isn't transferring the property. not in preparing to transfer the property.
On the vagueness issue, you said why you don't think it's vague. You know, you've gone through on the conversion issues. As far as Mr. Cornell pointing out the statute and some of this kind of, you know, language that maybe is a little difficult to follow that he took issue with, or what's your thoughts on that, on the preamble and all of the statute?
I didn't see the ambiguity. The premise seems to be that a family member can't have trust and confidence in another. And I said I'm unfamiliar with that concept, and that would seem to preclude things like embezzlement among family members, and that would seem to be a crime as well. So certainly, a stepchild can enjoy the trust and confidence of their step-parent, and if that hadn't happened, enjoying the trust and confidence, the stepchild converts property with the intent to permanently deprive, that would seem to be the end of it. Mm-hmm. It's only if you take the other section where it mentions acquired property without the intent by undue influence, you say, well, that much. It could be thrown into question by the exception. Mm-hmm. The exception about normal family influence. Well, if we never get to the exception, we don't matter too much if the exception is there or not.
What about his argument about the and or? And I think in the jury instruction, he's talking about the jury instruction with the and or, where if you want it's in favor of one person, if it's or, it's in favor of another person. Or I should say the state.
Well, as I understand it, when you mean the phrase and/or, it means you can use either one of these. You can use it if you find that those acquisition by undue influence and conversion, you can find it guilty. And if you find that it was acquired by undue influence or conversion.
It was a general verdict?
But there was no question answered by the jury except the general verdict.
Do you defend the interrogation of the defendant asking her to compare and contrast the testimony of others and to say whether she thought they were lying, or do you acknowledge that was improper?
Well, as my children and I want to say that in the playground, and she did it first. So that is an exception to the general rule that we shouldn't goad people into questioning someone else's veracity. But indeed,
that's not proper questioning, civil or criminal law.
Right. But there is an exception to that, and it was where the witness started it.
On cross by your office.
The question itself was appropriate. The response was that I'm disappointed that he's not telling the truth. I can't remember the exact language it was.
Even if it was there, it was harmless, is that your...
Yes, and I also think this court ought to revisit the line of cases that says that's because this is not the right case for that. I'll skip that. But I do say it can't be plain error to do that, because there may be some defendants, including this defendant, that want nothing more than to have their credibility contrasted with someone else. You shouldn't deprive the defendant of that, and I'm done here.
Before Mr. McCarthy sits down, may I ask a question?
Certainly.
I'm a little bit concerned about the statute, and let me pose to you this hypothetical. I may have a normal relationship with an older person, or my husband may have a normal relationship with me as an older person. And let us further assume, with the statute in mind, that I, at some point in time, perfectly competent, et cetera, say I want to transfer this piece of property to you, I want you to have this, et cetera. And then something happens, whether it's hip replacement or something else. And as I think the testimony supports in this case, something happens to I no longer remember adequately, I don't even remember that was my intent, or that it was my parents' intent, whichever generation you want to use. My question is, under this statute in its present form, and potentially because of the vagueness that has been pointed out to us, can I be not subject to its terms and criminal sanctions at one time, and then subsequently subject to its terms and conditions because of what I see as the ambiguity in the statute? At one time, it's normal family influence. At another time, it may be perceived by the state as undue influence.
My response is that if the grantor was competent at the time, that there's neither conversion nor acquisition.
Which time?
At the time of the transfer.
Okay.
The problem is not, once again, we have an assumption here that Mr. Walker simply forgot. The assumption that he testified, I don't recall. Well, that assumption is untrue. He testified it never happened. I never wished it. I never agreed to it. This was converted without my consent. That's grossly different from the scenario you presented, Justice.
And so you don't think that the statute is capable of being used in the manner that I described, taking two different points in time, one not being criminal in nature and another giving rise to a case like this?
I don't think it can become, a transfer can become criminal by virtue of later developments. No, I don't know. The evidence may be in dispute about whether the grantor was competent at the time, whether the grantee had the trust and confidence or a fiduciary relationship.
That's not for us to determine. Presumably, that was taken care of.
But the language of the statute doesn't affect that. I think the language of the statute is clear enough that we're talking about the moment of the transfer. Have I answered your question?
Yes, you have. Thank you.
And if there's nothing else, I'd like to get out of the way.
Thank you very much.
If I may, let me get back to the statute in a second. The basic problem with this case that I think we're grappling with is that the plaintiff in the civil case or the alleged victim is an elderly man who had a loss of memory as a result of a drug cocktail in the hospital in November of the year in question. The key question is what happened 2 months prior to that when we signed the escrow instructions.
And Mr. Cornell, is that part that you're about to get into, is that part of the record before us?
That's my problem. There's nothing in the record before us, but the way I look at this statute, it has to be in the record. The title company does not just come into a hospital like this unless they've got signed escrow instructions.
That's an argument that, yeah, if it's not in the record, I have problems with you making that argument.
Well, I understand. All I'm saying is the record is...
Because you're asking us to suppose.
Right. The record is totally silent on what my client did to get Mr. Walker to sign the escrow instructions, if anything, other than the Lone Ranger's testimony and my client's testimony that he was a very strong-willed, independent guy who had his own way of doing things, and this is what he wanted to do. Now, from there, it becomes difficult for me to believe that what the legislature had in mind was criminalizing actions, accepting a gift from somebody, not giving it back on demand as a conversion with the intent to permanently deprive. I don't think that's what the legislature had in mind with that statute at all, which is an issue that I think you grapple with if you think this statute is constitutional. Because the problem is what we have is an absence of evidence. Absence of evidence isn't proof of anything. Mr. Walker, at age 93, I had no memory of anything, therefore I did not agree to anything. that's, in my view, in the absence of evidence under any other name, and it's not sufficient legal proof. But again, we don't need to worry about that unless you find the statute to be constitutional. And with respect to let's start at the top and go down first, fine, when we start at the top, as I said before, we start with an acting of that person who has the trust and confidence in an older person. Who is that? Can that be a family member? It doesn't include the normal influence that one member of a family has over another, is the answer of the legislature. And we end up with and or to the jury, instructed the jury. And the point of and or is when we use a phrase like and or, we're throwing it in the jury's lap. You decide what the elements of the crime is. That is the hallmark under Smith versus Gauguin of an unconstitutionally vague statute. And that's why we submit in the final analysis this statute is exactly that. Thank you very much.
Thank you. This matter will be submitted. And